Okay, thank you very much for inviting me, first of all. And as it was said, I'm really a physicist, so I'm not a biologist. So I'll be talking about biology, but there are probably biology in the audience. Please keep me check whatever I say. I started working on biology in the last year or so. You'll see that there are a number of very interesting questions that are arising in understanding ecosystems in the ocean. And there is a strong interaction between the physics and the biology, much more than there is on land. It's just that the environment in the ocean is changing so fast that biology has to adapt instantly, essentially, to this new environment. So ecosystems in the ocean behave very differently from ecosystems on land from that perspective, and that's why there is a lot of interesting research that is emerging. The work I present today is done in collaboration mostly with two people. Sophia Merrifield is a graduate student at MIT working with me mostly on the work that I'll show at the end of the talk, and John Taylor is a postdoc that is now a lecturer, used to be a postdoc working with me on this problem. Now he's a lecturer at the University of Cambridge, the other Cambridge in the UK. And just to make sure, the title is Turbulence in and the Spring Phytoplankton Bloom. I'll introduce you to what I mean by turbulence and what I mean by phytoplankton bloom, so you shouldn't assume anything. I've been told that here in Toronto you don't ask questions during seminars. I think it's a very bad idea, so please ask questions. So first of all, just to understand what a phytoplankton bloom is. This is a picture taken off the coast of New Zealand. And it's a picture of the surface ocean from a satellite. You're just seeing color. That's what we want to look at. And what you see is that it's mostly blue. When the ocean is very blue and dark blue, it means that there is hardly any life in it. Life in this particular picture exists a bit along the coast where you see it start becoming greenish. That's because all of a sudden you have pigments in the water. There is phytoplankton, these microscopic algae that are growing around here, and so they color the water at the surface. So here I'm just giving you an example. It's a day in spring where the ocean is incredibly dark. Now, I take a picture, or I show a picture from the satellite 2 weeks later, and all of a sudden you see that the ocean has become colored. It has stuff in it. This, you're just looking at chlorophyll concentration at the surface. It has increased dramatically. That happens over 2 weeks. In a very short time scale, you went from a situation that you could compare to a desert on land to a situation you would probably compare more to a jungle on land. So the environment has changed so dramatically that all of a sudden growth was possible. This is an enhanced color picture. If I look at the real color picture, we just look bluish, but with this, all this white stuff appearing inside. That's something you can look at off the coast of the ocean, anywhere you go. There are times where all of a sudden things seem to bloom instantly or in a very fast time scale. That's not what you would see on land, where indeed there is a spring bloom in a sense, because as the spring comes around, leaves appear on trees, but it takes much longer time. On top of it, it's not that anything between these two pictures changed dramatically in the system. It's not that insulation changed dramatically over that time. It's not that the sky became all of a sudden clear. It's not that the ocean properties changed dramatically. So the question was, why is it? This is what we call a phytoplankton bloom. It's happening instantaneously, and we want to understand why that happens. Just to convince you that this is not just an event that happens off the coast of New Zealand with not particular global relevance, just want to make the point that blooms, I'm going to run a movie here, blooms happens the world ocean over. We are going to look mostly at high latitudes, where all of a sudden every spring you're going to see that the whole ocean becomes green and then it recedes at high latitudes, become a bit more bluish, and then it becomes green again as the new spring comes around. Turns out that during these events, you produce nearly half of the biomass in the ocean, meaning half of the primary productivity in the ocean happens in this spring bloom, in this bloom event. So it's a large fraction of the productivity. Half of the productivity globally on Earth happens on the ocean. So you're talking about 25% of productivity happens during this event. So they are very large effects. So let's try to see a movie. Now you see, if you're looking up here, now it's all green, and then it will become here, super green. Then it becomes darker. Then it becomes super green again. A bloom occurs. So cyclically, every year, you get a new bloom occurring. It's a pretty global phenomenon. I'm going to discuss, especially at the end of the talk, what happens mostly in the North Atlantic, where you see this big spring bloom. It's not the only place where it happens. It happens at high latitude in the Atlantic, a bit in the Pacific and the Southern Ocean. We're going to focus on the North Atlantic, where we have most data. So the theory that I described early on will apply essentially to every bloom you can think of, but then the specifics will be looked in the North Atlantic, where there's a very strong signal where we have data. Just so that we know what we're looking at, I said that this blooms that happens every year are made of phytoplankton. What we mean specifically are these microscopic algae that have very interesting shapes. If you're a biologist, you probably appreciate more the shapes than the rest of the talk. That we start with things that can be, they're microscopic, so we're talking about micron size elements. So they can be things as small as prochlorococci that have scales of order 1 micron. You can have coccolithophores, they have these very nice shell structures, more of order of tens of microns. There are dinoflagellates, they have to start having some flagella with which they can swim. They're more between the 10 to 100 microns. And the largest of them all, the diatoms, we're still talking about hundreds of microns. Very nice structure. All of these together is what we're going to collectively call phytoplankton. So there are a lot of different species embedded in this story. We're talking about their collective behavior and why do they start growing all of a sudden. But you have to keep in mind that there is a lot of diversity within that picture. Important in the definition of phytoplankton is plankton that is able to photosynthesize, so it depends on light to photosynthesize, and it's, what do I want to say about this one? It's plankton that is able to photosynthesize, but it is non-motile. So it's going to depend in its motion, on its, for its motion, completely on the movements of the water. We are not talking about zooplankton or higher trophic levels that have strong locomotion capabilities, and then they can decide where they want to go. So now, this should have given an introduction on what is the phytoplankton and what is a phytoplankton bloom. Now, just very quickly to give you an idea, why do we care about that? I said a lot of the primary productivity is associated with that. Again, you might say, well, that's an interesting intellectual challenge, but there are really practical implications. First of all, the phytoplankton is at the base of the food chain in the sea. I mean, all other trophic levels eventually feed on the phytoplankton. First, we have phytoplankton, the zooplankton feeds on the phytoplankton. The nectons, meaning the higher trophic levels that we rely on to eat fish, rely eventually on the zooplankton. So to understand what supplies and maintains phytoplankton population is equivalent to understanding the basic of the trophic levels all the way up to fisheries. The other important aspect of the problem is that when you have photosynthesis going on in the water column, what you're really doing is you're taking some carbon that eventually comes from the atmosphere that is stored as part of photosynthesis in organic material. A fraction of that carbon eventually sinks to the ocean bottom, both as excrements or just dying particles. And it's stored for a very long time at the bottom of the ocean. So it's an efficient way to extract carbon from the atmosphere and put it into the ocean in what is called the soft tissue pump or the biological pump. If you look, for example, in the North Atlantic, you see a lot of carbon uptake. Part of that signal is just that there is a lot of biological activity that draws down carbon levels. This dark colors means that there is a flux from the atmosphere into the ocean. As I said, a fraction of that signal is indeed biological. The other fraction is just this water are colder, so they tend to dissolve carbon. Just to say that the full carbon cycle depends on understanding in detail how phytoplankton grows and where. So maybe let me go back a second and I'll introduce that. So what do you need if we want to understand how phytoplankton blooms arise? We need to understand what is needed for phytoplankton to grow in the first place. So we want to have a fundamental understanding of what it takes for biology, or phytoplankton in particular, to grow in the ocean. And this is a very simple cartoon it's going to go. We said that these are photosynthetic organisms, so the first thing they need is light. If there is no light, you cannot have photosynthesis, so blooms definitely depend on the presence of light in the water column. This is not going to stand. Okay. So you need phytoplankton, you need light. You need carbon dioxide. Well, carbon dioxide in the water column is not really a problem. There is always some carbon that dissolves from above into the water column, so carbon is always present, but it needs to be there. The other thing you need is that phytoplankton, carbon dioxide by itself is not all you need. As we said, light is what gives the energy to phytoplankton, but you also need material to form, to construct cells, so you also need nutrients. Nutrients, we'll see in a second, in the ocean are typically stored at depth in the ocean. Once you have nutrients, meaning phosphate, nitrates, or whatever else you need to build cell material plus light, you can get photosynthesis going, and all of a sudden you can have growth of organic material, meaning the cell starts reproducing, the phytoplankton starts growing. So we have to keep in mind that the real key ingredients that we need are, first of all, light, but light penetrates only from the surface ocean down to, say, 50 to 100 meters, depending on the clarity of water. So you have to be very close to the surface in the ocean to get any light. Nutrients, I said instead, for example, phosphate, this is a section across the Pacific, this is depth, and this is latitude from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere. Dark red colors means very large concentration, blue colors means very low concentration. You see that all the phosphates are really at depth. It's mostly because the biology has eaten whatever was at the surface. So now, if you are a new phytoplankton coming into the game, well, you want to be deep enough to get some of the nutrients. If you're just close to the surface, you have no nutrients, you still cannot grow, even though you have plenty of light. So you're a bit in a catch-22 situation where you want to have the light, which is close to the surface, and the nutrients that are below. To make the story even worse, so you must be a pretty stressed organism, as I said, you cannot choose where to swim. You're just at the mercy of ocean currents. If we take a section of the ocean, so this is a section from east to west, well, this is in particular, it doesn't matter where it's taken from, it's very typical, this would be from the US coast all the way close to Hawaii, I guess. And we are looking at potential density, this is depth, this is the density of the water. I mean, this is very dense water, then it's becoming lighter as you move up. So you see that when you are deep in the ocean, this is a very dense layer, a lighter layer. The density is changing very fast with height. You can think of the ocean as a set of layers of different densities sitting on top of each other and oscillating. But when you come within 100 meters or so at the surface, all of a sudden, the density doesn't change with height anymore. It's very well mixed. That's because you have strong turbulence all the time blowing on top of the ocean. You have winds that will generate turbulence, and that turbulence starts mixing the water column. Or you can have cooling, in particular in high latitudes. That's what you're going to see happening in winter. You just cool the water from massive heat loss, and that will mix again vertically, the water column. So there is like a big spoon constantly acting and mixing the upper ocean, much like with your spoon, you stir milk and coffee, and you mix them together. So that part of the ocean is always get mixed. And phytoplankton wants to live up here. That's the only place where it stands any chance to live because it's close to light, but it also means that this spoon is going to move it up and down across the mixed layer. And in some way, it has to find a good way. Or this is the physics controlling the dynamics, and it wants to be close enough to the surface and close enough to the nutrients in some way so that everything conspires and allows growth to occur. So getting at what we're going to look at in detail, we want to understand what triggers a phytoplankton bloom, and I've given you what are the fundamental elements or the recipe for a bloom to occur. You want to have light, nutrients, and a mixed layer depth that apparently is deep enough to get some nutrients, but not too shallow. But not too deep so that you're not far away from light. So we see what has been classical theories, what the classical theories are for the onset of phytoplankton bloom. That's a problem that biological oceanographers have been thinking about for a long time, for at least a century. We'll see what are some pitfalls of this theory once you start looking a bit more in detail, meaning how predictive it truly is. We'll try to revise the theory and try to understand a bit more in detail what is the role of physics in this story, and we'll test this argument with remote sensing data, and here I'm saying that we'll also use some in situ data. Given the pace I'm going at, I don't think we'll do this part, which is less important. I think the remote sensing will give us the big picture. So what is the classical view at this point? Why is it that the spring bloom occurs at some time in the year? That is work that was due mostly to Raleigh and Sverdrup in 1940, around that time. Their idea was, well, what is happening in winter, if you are thinking about high latitudes, is that turbulence is very strong because there is massive cooling, there are very strong winds, weather is not particularly nice. You probably teach me here that indeed the winter is not a great time. And turbulence, therefore, must be penetrating very deep. So you have a very deep mixed layer. It's deep enough that it starts tapping in the pool of nutrients at depth. You remember that you need nutrients. So you start flooding the whole mixed layer where this organism lives with plenty of nutrients. Except that it's so deep that you're not spending much time in the light zone. So you're in conditions that are typically called light limited. You just don't have enough lights, but you would have plenty of nutrients. So this is what happens through the whole winter. You've seen those pictures I showed at the beginning. There is hardly any life because things cannot grow. They just do not experience enough light to photosynthesize. But then, fortunately, everywhere, well, if you don't go quite at the North Pole, nearly everywhere, eventually winter stops. And so when that happens, all of a sudden what it means is the surface forcing is not as strong. The winds are not as bad. The cooling eventually reverts to warming from the surface. So you're not mixing as deep in the water column. All of a sudden you start mixing a bit less. So this mixed layer that was very deep, let's say 100-200 meters deep in winter, well, all of a sudden it starts becoming progressively shallower. As the mixed layer shoals, there must be one day where finally you still have plenty of nutrients, nobody's eating there, but one day there must be one day when all of a sudden there is enough light that growth can occur. And so the idea is that it's just that particular day when all of a sudden there is enough light that the spring bloom will develop. This is an idea that I'm attributing to Raleigh and Sverdrup. It had been already discussed in the past in the biological community, but it was at the same, in the sense of a cartoon like this. The idea was that, yeah, it's really the mixed layer that becomes shallower in spring, and there must be one day where conditions are right, and that's when you see all of a sudden a bloom occurring. The problem was that it's a story, so there is no way to falsify it because it's not making any clear-cut prediction. So really, Raleigh and Sverdrup, what they really contributed, they started saying, what is the simplest model we can build of growth and onset of a phytoplankton bloom that we could use to test some of these hypotheses? And so what they said is, well, we are going to write an equation for the phytoplankton concentration P. So P is phytoplankton concentration, dP dt is the growth rate of phytoplankton, and we are going to put the minimum biology and the minimum physics that we think we can get away with to make a prediction. So the model will include some growth rate at the rate mu times P, so that population grows exponentially in time, everything else being kept constant, and there is some mortality M. This is both intrinsic mortality, it could be viral infections, or it could be predation by other organisms. The difference between the growth and the mortality is that the growth, as I said, depends on light. And light is decaying exponentially with depth, essentially. So you grow very fast where there is a lot of light. Typical growth rate for a phytoplankton of the kinds I've shown might be growth rates of once per day. Well, that is close at the surface, but then as you move down, and this is a function of depth, I'm showing the growth curve is going from high values and then it's decaying exponentially to zero to much smaller value at depth, just because there is no light. Mu is a function of light. Predation instead is much less depth dependent because you're predated through the whole water column. It's not that the fact that there is light, and the organism here don't have a visual system, so they don't rely on light in particular to predate, so this M is depth independent. So this is the minimum biology that seems to be fundamental for biology to grow. And now, the physics. What is the minimum physics I can get away with? Well, I said that to leading order, what is happening if you are in the upper part of the water column is that you are constantly mixed in the vertical. And so we are going to represent all that physics just with a vertical diffusion equation. It's just that kappa T is a turbulent diffusivity that represents how fast I mix properties in the vertical, and this kappa T is supposedly different from zero from the surface down to some mixed layer depth, and then the kappa T is essentially zero below. So I am only mixing within what I call the mixed layer. So this is the simple model where it has biology and physics, and we're going to try to use it to understand some fundamental properties of phytoplankton blooms, and then we'll try to test this very idealized model with something a bit more realistic and then against real data. Just so that we are all on the same board, when it comes to prescribing this growth rate function, I'm going to prescribe the growth rate as a function of mu naught. This is the value of growth at the surface, and then an exponential function that decays as e to the z over hl. Z is negative on this axis, so it's decaying away from the surface. Z equal to zero is at the surface. Hl is the characteristic scale over which light penetrates. So just remember, hl is order of 10 meters or so. It's the scale over which the light penetration decays by a factor of e. Natural E. So how can you use this model and following Sverdrup essentially to make predictive theory of phytoplankton blooms? Well, Sverdrup said, let me assume that turbulence in the ocean is always very strong. And what I mean by very strong is that turbulence is so strong that it makes properties in the vertical much faster than any biological time scale. We said that growth rate are order of one per day. Predation rate typically in population kind we'll see of order of one every 10 days, 0.1 per day. So what we're saying is that if you mix constantly much faster than that, the phytoplankton will be always uniform through how they mix layer because sources, meaning growth and sinks, are going to be slower than that. So if the growth rate is very fast in the vertical, now you can actually determine where when dP dt is going to be positive or when it's going to be negative. When dP dt positive means that you have a bloom, you're growing, and dP dt negative means that nothing can grow. If I said that P is going to be constant, well, what I really mean is that I'm in a mixed layer where everything is kept mixed constantly all the time, and therefore I can have growth if the average light that I see gives me a growth rate that is larger than the mortality within that layer, meaning that the phytoplankton is never sitting at the surface for a long time. it's just moving up and down, so it sees a bit of the highlight region, but a bit of the low lit region at the bottom of the mixed layer. So you just take the vertically integrated mu must be larger than the vertically integrated m. If that's the case, the vertically integrated mu is larger than the vertically integrated m, then I can have growth, because growth rates outpaces mortality over that mixed layer. However, the mixed layer is much deeper than that. Remember that m keeps going down. If I take the vertical integral, I get this red area, but if I make the mixed layer deeper and deeper and deeper, at some point the mortality will outpace the growth. So for very deep mixed layer, there will be no growth. I can actually compute the critical depth, as has been called since Sverdrup's time, when the vertical integrated mu is equal to the vertical integrated m, when mortality is exactly balancing growth. So I have a steady population. So if hc, which turns out to be equal to the penetration depth of light times mu naught, the growth rate at the surface, divided by m. So if in winter h, the mixed layer depth is much deeper than this critical depth, and now I know how to represent it in terms of measurable parameters in theory, well, if h is larger than hc, no growth can occur because the PDT is negative, so any population will just die out. However, if h, the mixed layer depth, is less than hc, so now I'm pretty shallow, all of a sudden the vertically integrated mu is outpacing the death rate, and so in that case the PDT is positive, I have a bloom. So the idea is that when h is equal to hc, it's that day of the year that all of a sudden a bloom should develop. You should already have some doubts that this is really a predictive theory, because we can measure hl, we know radii properties of water. Mu naught, the growth rate of individual organisms, is something you can measure. Just by doing lab culture, you can see how fast, possibly, an organism can reproduce. M, however, is very hard, because it depends on things like predation. Well, that requires knowing that particular part of the water column, what is the ecosystem, and at what rate it predates. So in practice, it will be pretty hard to measure the M itself. But apart from that caveat, we can try to test the theory. And that has been done a number of times since the time of Sverdrup. In particular, here I'm showing one example. It's going to be pretty representative of what typically happens when you try to test the theory. Here it's data collected by Weather Station M. It's a weather ship that was off the coast of Norway, a US weather ship. And I'm going to show you three panels. This is work that is done by SARS and collaborators. So we're going to look at three panels. This is time through the year, from January to December. And first I'm going to show the density difference from the surface and 75 meters. In winter, you expect that difference to be essentially zero, because you're looking within the mixed layer. We said that the density doesn't change in the vertical, so the density of the surface 75 meters should be essentially the same. That's what you see here. This is zero. It means that the density is hardly changing between those two points. But then at some point in April, May, you see that that difference starts increasing. That means that the density between the surface 75 meters is very different. The mixed layer must have become shallower than 75 meters. They've chosen 75 meters because, regardless of the uncertainty that I quoted on M, we know that the critical depth of Sverdrup is going to be definitely shallower than 75 meters itself. So you're just saying, if you are at this time of the year when the mixed layer is deeper than 75 meters, according to Sverdrup, no growth should occur. You're definitely deeper than the critical depth for reasonable parameters of mu naught, M, and HL. It's very hard to see how you could be deeper than that. Now, the other thing maybe I should point out, you see that there are a lot of points on these curves. It's just that they repeated this measurement over 3 years. So you see that there are squares, triangles, and circles. This is just repeating the same measurement at that spot over 3 years. So you see that cycle repeating every year. Now we measure chlorophyll concentration. You see, again, very low value of chlorophyll in winter, and then all of a sudden the values spike up. So that is what we call a bloom. All of a sudden, the values of chlorophyll concentration went up because growth started occurring in the water column. They also measure nutrients, in this particular case, nitrates. So you see very high nutrients through the winter. That's the mixed layer became deep enough that it got flooded with nutrients. But then as soon as the chlorophyll increases, meaning photosynthesis occurs, well, you draw down the nutrients and the mixed layer becomes depleted until you get in the next autumn, the mixed layer comes deep again and you replenish it. So now we can test a bit Sverdrup hypothesis with this data set. I said these results will be typical. Let's first look at when did the bloom occur. So this is the plot of chlorophyll. And I would contend, well, maybe there is already some growth in March, but definitely by April, you see that this thing is that the chlorophyll signal starts growing. So I just draw a line in April. This is when the bloom should have occurred. Now I want to see when is it that the mixed layer starts changing its depth or becoming shallower than 75 meters. Well, that doesn't happen until May at least. So it's at least a year later. That's a typical observation. You'll find out that if you try to look at Sverdrup hypothesis, it's true that at some point in spring, the bloom occurs and the mixed layer is changing over that time. But if you look quantitatively, Sverdrup hypothesis typically predicts that the bloom should have started much later or much after what you actually observe in the data. So it's telling you that. As I said, this is one example. It turns out that it's very hard to see how you make it any deeper than that in any case. But that said, people have tried to estimate more in detail the predation rate from satellite pictures looking at the decay phase of the curve. So you can be a bit more quantitative. In this particular case, I think, if I remember, the Sverdrup depth is something closer to 50 meters. So you're a bit below. Whether that is the case, wow. Being reminded about time. I would contend that what is really the case is that every time you try to do these studies independently, you find out that you are predicting the onset of the bloom a bit too late. That said, if you go into the literature, it's important to keep a caveat. And in a lot of cases, what people do, instead of testing the hypothesis, they are going to use the critical depth criterion and say that that is the correct criterion. I'm using that criterion to estimate what M, what the predation rate is. So in that case, of course, by definition, it's going to work because you fix the only parameter you don't know to make the theory work. But that's not an independent validation. Now, I have to accelerate, but it has been pointed out in the biological literature as well that, indeed, you can also have growth if you suppress the turbulence itself. Right? Now, let's not worry about how deep the mixed layer is. We can make it even infinitely deep. You're already meaning that the mixed layer or the water column was mixed very deeply. And now, all of a sudden, I just turned down the turbulent diffusivity and make it very weak. Like, I'm still mixing pretty far down, but very slowly. Well, if this term was identically zero, you know that the surface mu z is larger than m, so growth can occur. So in work we've done with John Taylor, you can be a bit more quantitative. You can actually define what is a critical diffusivity. If kappa t, the diffusivity, is larger than this critical value, then the turbulence is strong enough to prevent any growth, even if the mixed layer, with a mixed layer much deeper than Sverdrup condition. But if kappa t is less, the turbulent diffusivity is less than some critical value, even if the mixed layer is much deeper than the critical value suggested by Sverdrup, you can still have growth. Right? So it could be that in winter, the turbulence is very strong, just because you're mixing not very deep, but also very fast, you have growth. But in spring, it's just that you're not mixing as fast at some point, even though the mixed layer might still be deep. And then you can have a bloom. You start, the fact that I was suggesting that blooms occur a bit early in the season might have a lot to do with, indeed, the fact that maybe it's early in the season the turbulence just went down. The mixed layer hasn't really changed yet. This is just suggestive. The problem, as you see, is that now what I'm asking you is to check turbulent diffusivity hypothesis, the kappa C, which depends on, again, the light penetration, mu naught, and M. So all the caveat that I raised about Sverdrup hypothesis applies to this one, except that it's a bit worse because it's also difficult to measure just the turbulent diffusivity itself in the water column close to the ocean surface. So it's not very easy to test the hypothesis in this form. So how are we going to proceed is that, well, what we know is that turbulence is generated by surface forcing. So if we are thinking about the North Atlantic, what this turbulence is responding to is just that you have a massive cooling at the surface. There is very strong heat loss from the ocean. The water at the surface becomes very dense and creates a layer on the top of the ocean, what we call the mixed layer, which has very turbulent plumes that keep being mixed up and down. But we know how that turbulent diffusivity is caused with the surface heat flux, or buoyancy flux. Buoyancy is heat flux in units of acceleration. It doesn't matter what it is, but consider it as a heat flux, times a depth. So I know how to relate the diffusivity to things I can measure. I mean, we were talking about mixed layer depth and heat fluxes, so at least we can go back to something we can measure because we can relate the two. This is just a simulation, you see things being mixed. This is a turbulence that mixes properties in the vertical. Well, but now if I can relate my surface heat flux to my turbulent diffusivity, or if I invert this equation now, I can express B naught as a function of turbulent diffusivity at the mixed layer depth. Now, I can also, instead of defining a critical turbulence, kappa C, I can define a critical buoyancy flux or heat flux. Right? All I have to do is I plug into kappa T my kappa C. Now I have a BC. Is the turbulent, is the critical heat flux or the critical buoyancy flux? Let's see. Yeah, I have a critical heat flux expressed in this way. So I have now a critical heat flux that tells me that if the heat flux is larger than that, it's negative, and larger than that, no growth can occur. If it's smaller than that value, instead, all of a sudden, growth can occur. Now, if you look at this expression again, it's depending on all the usual parameters. It's not terribly useful in that sense that I haven't made progress in terms of what it depends on, except I made progress because I can measure a turbulent flux at the surface of the ocean is something I can reasonably well constrain, much better than a kappa, the turbulent diffusivity. But now, this is where the story becomes very simple. Now I can start playing and ask for a range of values. You can solve this problem, by the way. Here I keep giving you a heuristic argument. You can solve these equations analytically for any parameters you want. So now you can ask, as a function of mu naught, m, h, and hl, what are typical values of this critical heat flux? Turns out for reasonable parameters in the ocean and for a wide range of biological parameters, the critical heat flux is never very far from 0 to order 10 watts per meter squared. That's essentially zero practical purposes. What we are saying is really that as long as there is a negative heat flux on top of the ocean, growth cannot occur. It generates enough turbulence to prevent growth. It's just as soon as you turn the heat flux off, which is something that happens as you go from winter to spring, one day finally the cooling subsides and you have started having some heat flux into the ocean warming, it's on that day that indeed the condition should change and growth could occur. Now this statement all of a sudden doesn't depend on any of the biological parameters, so it's much more testable. So the first thing we've done is that we tested this argument with a numerical model. So what's the difference of the numerical model compared to what I've done before is that now all of a sudden, instead of representing my vertical mixing just like a vertical diffusion equation, now I'm going to resolve the full three-dimensional motion that develop in the ocean when I apply a sort of heat flux at the top. The same as if you look at your coffee cup, I said that, well, when you stir with a spoon, eventually thing gets mixed, but you can solve for the full fluid dynamics to actually see all the filaments of milk and coffee that develop before it gets mixed, so you're not trying to prescribe the answer. We are going to solve the equation over a 200 by 200 meters patch of ocean and 100 meters deep. So it's a very small patch of ocean. I'm going to prescribe a heat loss at the surface and then just let it go. We are using, for the experts here, a large eddy simulation kind of approach. And, well, this is the grid resolution and these are the parameters that I impose in the problem. That doesn't matter too much. But now I start with a simulation where the depth is deeper than the critical depth. As I'm showing you one example, it's an example before. Now you're looking at phytoplankton concentration. The depth was larger than the critical depth of Sverdrup. So according to Sverdrup, no growth should occur in this simulation. However, I put a heat flux of just minus 1 watt per meter squared. It's a very small heat flux. So the mixed layer is very deep. It remains deep enough to prevent growth by itself. But wherever you see green, it means that there is actually growth in the phytoplankton concentration. So indeed, in this system, the heat flux was weak enough that growth could occur. We can go a bit beyond that. No, don't consider this panel, but just these two. First, this is a time series. The heat flux now starts from minus 100 watts per meter squared. So now I'm doing time evolving simulation. It's like the same I've shown you before, but now I'm taking the heat flux to start with minus 100 watts per meter squared. That's pretty strong heat flux, winter condition. I'm just cooling the surface of the ocean for a day or so. And then this is like a transition from winter to springtime condition. The heat flux all of a sudden decreases to zero, and then I keep it at zero. The prediction of that we just made is that it's really when the heat flux hits zero all of a sudden that a gloom should develop. Now here I'm showing you the results from this numerical simulation that we forced. It did all the interesting phases that you've seen before. Now I'm showing as a function of depth the phytoplankton concentration. When it's green, it means that there is very little phytoplankton in the water column. Again, I start this simulation. The white lines are density surface. If you want, this is where the water is strongly stratified. Above is where there is a mixed layer. So the mixed layer is always very deep, deeper than the critical depth. In this case, I can compute analytically. So I know that, again, according to Sverdrup, no growth should occur through the whole simulation here. Now, what I show is that over this time up to here, essentially no growth was occurring. But as soon as the heat flux goes to zero, the growth, meaning this big patch of red phytoplankton concentration, is increasing. So here you see the phytoplankton concentration is very low, but here it becomes very high. So a bloom has developed as soon as the heat flux was turned off. So the prediction here is that you have something that's much more available to you, which is just the heat flux at the surface of the ocean, at least in the North Atlantic in open ocean condition. It's when the heat flux gets turned off that the bloom should occur. Is that independent of
the depth condition that Sverdrup was talking about? And the answer is directly yes. And in what sense? Well, if you want your mixed layer to change, as I said, the mixed layer in the first place was very deep because I was mixing very deep. The first thing I have to stop doing for the mixed layer to change, I have to stop mixing. As long as I mix, the mixed layer is not going to become any shallower. The turbines will keep penetrating. When I stop mixing, the mixed layer will tend to, what oceanographers like to call it, restratify. If you leave it enough time, you're warming it from the top, eventually you get a layer that is again progressively becoming stratified. It's not mixed anymore because I not keep mixing. It unmixes itself because the dense water will go under the warmer water. But that process takes a while. So that would explain why there was a lag between the onset of a bloom and the prediction of Sverdrup, because indeed you would expect the heat flux to turn off first, and then after a while the mixed layer to start changing and satisfying Sverdrup criteria. So we can try to test this idea, as I said, with remote sensing data from satellites, and to start seeing to what extent we have some skill. The first is going to be just an example, so take it as just as you want to see to what extent this theory has some skill. Yeah. Is it a sanity check? So what I'm going to show you first is an example taken from the subpolar gyre. So we're going to use two products. One is, as I said, from color pictures from satellite, you can reconstruct chlorophyll concentration. We're going to take a big patch. The latitude and longitude is written here, but it's a big patch in the North Atlantic, in the subpolar gyre, meaning it's north of 45 degrees north, where this theory should apply. Because as I said, there is plenty of nutrients, the mixed layer becomes very deep, and all the story I told you does apply. So I'm going to show you two curves. This is a function of year for 1, 2, 3 years. And the red line is the heat flux in that patch of ocean. Again, heat flux we can take from what are called reanalysis in the atmosphere. We monitor how heat fluxes enter in and out of the ocean. So in winter, the heat flux are negative, meaning the heat flux is out of the ocean, you're cooling. And then you enter in spring, and all of a sudden you're warming. Then you cool again. Another spring, you warm, you cool, you warm, you cool. You spend most of the time cooling because you are at high latitudes, right? So you see this cycle. Now, the prediction is every time the heat flux is crossing zero here for a substantial amount of time, we mean we're going to take a criterion, the heat flux has to remain positive for at least 8 days, we predict that the bloom should develop. Well, now I'm going to plot these black dots are amount of chlorophyll concentration as measured from space. You see here very low concentration. This is the axis here. We see very low concentration. Then all of a sudden, a jump in chlorophyll concentration right up here. And that is essentially coincident with the time when the heat flux change sign. Again, low values of chlorophyll concentration, the heat flux change in sign, and there is a bump in growth rate. Again, here, it's very low concentration. Now, notice that this is a logarithmic scale. So when you see this jump, you see that you have a change by an order of magnitude in concentration, then boom, the chlorophyll concentration goes up. So for this patch of the North Atlantic, at least there is a self-consistent. The argument does seem to have some skill. You shouldn't take it as proof of anything. It's just showing that at least it's worth looking into it. Just to reinforce the argument, I could apply the same analysis to the subtropical gyre. Now I'm moving farther south. We are south of 40 degrees north. It's another patch of the North Atlantic, where I said blooms are not really observed in the same way, and it's nutrient limitation that becomes a real issue. The mixed layer is never deep enough in this part of the ocean to ever get nutrients at the surface, so you're really in a very different regime. So I'm only showing it to show that in this case, the chlorophyll concentration doesn't jump up necessarily when the heat flux changes sign, just to show the theory has some skill in what we look at in the subpolar gyre, and it doesn't seem to have much skill by the time we look in the subtropical gyre, as it shouldn't. So now I think I have nearly to stop. I'll show this one as one of many statistical analyses we've done since, just to convince ourselves that indeed that correlation is pretty strong. One thing I can do is to look now, I'm plotting as a function of time, these are days, I pick for every year, I sample days in every point in the North Atlantic. Now it's done point-wise. I'm not taking a big average as I was doing before. For every point in the North Atlantic, I look at what is the day when the heat fluxes changes sign. And I'm going to plot all the data as days after the heat flux change sign and before the heat flux change sign. And I'm showing you the growth rate of phytoplankton. So I'm really plotting 1 over P dP dP, 1 over P dP dT, right? The growth rate. Now, what you see is that this is in the subtropical gyre, again, the same region I looked at before where the theory should apply. You see very low growth rate most of the time, but a big spike right around when the heat fluxes crosses zero. Now, this is a statistical realization. You're really looking, blooms over now is 12 years, and at every point I do this analysis and I plot all these points. I take these black dots are for every year, and now you take the averages, this green line. So you see the statistically, it's just the day when the heat flux change is signed that there is a big jump in growth rate. You don't see that at other times. Again, if you repeat the same analysis in the subtropical gyre where you don't expect anything dramatic to happen when the heat flux change sign, well, yeah, you don't see that at zero there is a particular bump in growth rates. Growth rates are typically small. The subtropical gyre, not much growth ever occurs. They're called oligotrophic region because there is very little productivity. This is always to show that it's a self-consistency check for the theory, to show that if you apply where it shouldn't hold, where not much growth occurs, it doesn't, but when you apply where it holds, indeed, you do see this spike. And what is quite remarkable about this, regardless of anything else, is that you're really testing an hypothesis. With Sverdrup critical hypothesis, you couldn't really do it because you can't really measure the growth rate, the decay rate, M, to the point that you could really be that quantitative. You can actually show that this prediction has quite a bit of skill in the North Atlantic where it's supposed to apply. We are skipping this. Was more of a discussion that we can do also in situ validation of these arguments. Here I'm looking at remote satellite data, but I can also look at a particular place where you have enough information. You see that the bloom actually doesn't occur uniformly through the North Atlantic everywhere at the same time. There is quite a bit of modulation. It depends on property of the water column. So we can in detail look at how the turbulence at a particular place should develop and see that indeed the bloom occurs where we expect and at the time we expect. But just to summarize, since I'm running out of time, I think what we try to show is that the onset of the North Atlantic spring bloom coincide with the change of heat flux, and there is quite a bit of support both from our theoretical understanding and from remote data, I mean satellite data. And so this change in heat flux is a better indicator of bloom initiation, as far as we can tell in these regions, than the critical depth. What is interesting in deep layers and weak turbulence can lead to a very large depth integrated biomass. The fact that there is an important implication of how the bloom occurs in how much biomass you can produce. Now, it's true that the growth happens only close to the surface because I reduce the turbulence, but then all that biomass can be, over longer time scale, just be mixed through the whole mixed layer. So the amount of biomass you can produce is much more than in the critical depth hypothesis, where the mixed layer overall has to be very shallow. So if growth happened much later in the season as in Sverdrup hypothesis, then you would produce less mass integrated biomass than if it happens earlier in the season in the way we are describing, because you can store a lot of that biomass underneath. It has important implications for the way we interpret satellite data. Nearly everything you see about satellite remote sensing data relies on the fact that phytoplankton is mixed through the whole mixed layer depth. It turns out that that's not the case. We know that at least in some of the blooms, that's clearly not what you observe. So the inferences, for example, about how much biomass you actually generate is not particularly accurate. Finally, as I said, what is interesting, especially if you like the physics of the problem and trying to take these large-scale integrals, is that lateral structure density changes or temperature changes at the surface of the water column modulate the turbulence. It's not just a function of the surface heat fluxes. You can see that those effects actually modulate exactly where bloom starts and when, so there is a fine-scale structure to the story that you can try to elaborate on, and it has, again, implication for what is the total integrated biomass. And I stop here.